Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour for January 28th, 2021. A very interesting topic to cover tonight. We're dealing with the planet Pluto, and it's been demoted from being a planet, interestingly enough. A whole political backlash from that event. I'll be talking about that and why that happened. But also just the amazing properties of Pluto, this little planet out at the edge of the solar system. And first of all, let me define or give the definition, the redefinition of planet. The planets were always, I mean, when you were in grade school 10, 20, 30 years ago, you learned that there were nine planets and you could recite them: Mercury, Earth, Venus, Earth, Mars, etc. And you included Pluto, which was the ninth planet. But all of a sudden that changed around the year 2010. There was some difficulty in corroborating the idea that there were more planets out there. These were other planets that were Pluto-sized, because they're small. They're relatively small compared to Earth. It's a little bit smaller than Earth's moon, which is quite a bit smaller than Earth itself. But still, it was considered a planet. Then it was discovered to have a moon, which one would consider to be a property of a planet. It would, you know, some object that has moons. Venus doesn't have any moons. Mercury doesn't have any moons. Mars has two little teeny asteroidal rocks going around it. They call it moons, but they're really not. They're just captured asteroids. So Earth has a moon. Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, of course, all have moons, but they're bigger. And so one would expect them to have moons. But little Pluto has five moons. And so it outdoes Earth, and certainly it outdoes the Mercury, Venus, Mars, in terms of having moons that are round themselves. So anyway, they redefined in 2018, they redefined the definition of a planet, so that they could kick Pluto out. It's kind of like moving the goalposts, literally in the astronomical sense. So anyway, the current, and I'm going to make a case that Pluto still qualifies as a planet. Or if Pluto doesn't qualify as a planet, then there's a lot of other planets that don't qualify as planets either. So let's look at these three qualifications. One is that it orbits the sun. Okay, Pluto does that. All of these other objects, in fact, many other objects, orbit the sun. So they would, under that one qualification, orbit the sun. They would qualify as being a planet, at least on that one qualification. Number two is that they have enough self-gravity to pull themselves into a circular or spherical shape. And now that also implies that there was some heat generated when they were forming. In other words, they were molten. And by being molten, the self-gravity pulled itself into this spherical shape. And like I said, Charon, which is one of Pluto's moons, is spherical also. So you would think that that would also qualify at least as being a moon of a planet. And then the third one is the Stickler, where they say that a planet, to be a planet, you have to clear out all of the region of the orbit. In other words, as it goes around the sun, it would clear out any objects that might be in that path around the sun. But I'm sure you could make a case that Uranus and Neptune have members that are in orbit, in their orbits, or in the region of their orbits, which have not been cleared away by their existence in that orbit. So do they really qualify as a planet? Maybe not. Maybe not. But at any rate, that's the new move the goalpost rule that eliminates Pluto as being a planet. But what really happened is NASA began to discover new planets. The first one, Sedna, I think was in 2004, was discovered by accident in a computerized telescopic search program. And then there were other ones, Quarar and other planets. And so there's a few more of them out there, a little bit smaller than Pluto. But then, all of a sudden, there was a plethora of discoveries. Hundreds of new planets, thousands of new planets. And then the idea that there was something big out there, a bigger planet. And NASA joined, finally, they had to break down in 2016 and admit that there was more than likely another big planet out there. Which, in the case of Pluto, if Pluto's planet 9, the ninth planet, then the next planet would be planet 10, or in Roman numerals, planet X. And they did not want to touch that with a 10-foot pole because of all the hullabaloo and all the tremendous public disinformation and the public awareness of planet 10. And then the question of would immediately be raised, well, if there's this big planet out there, is that what the ancients saw? Is that the planet Nibiru? And you would bring up all of these questions. So the astronomical community, the conservatives, the world controlling the astronomers that work for the Vatican, let's put it that way, who are attached to the New World Order and the secret societies and that are really looking for such objects and want you to be stupid about them, and they create these massive disinformation campaigns. Of course, they didn't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. So the easiest thing to do, rather than saying, well, gee, all those textbooks that you learned from when you were in grade school and high school and college, saying that there were nine planets, well, they were just wrong a little bit. We'll just get rid of that Pluto planet out there. And then we don't have to talk about those thousands of other planets that are Pluto-sized and some of them bigger, and just sweep that under the rug, as astronomers like to do. So that's what really happened to Pluto. Pluto is very much a planet, and like I say, they moved the goalposts, they changed the rules on what a planet was, and therefore the end result was Pluto being decommissioned as a planet. But in my world, Pluto is still very much a planet, and there are thousands of planets out there. Next, in future lecture, I'll be talking about the Kuiper Belt objects and how those form, etc. But where did Pluto come from? This little object out at the edge of the solar system. And here's some fun facts about Pluto. Pluto is this little object, and you could imagine if you had, for example, take a silver dollar, you know, and then take a penny. That would be about the size comparison of Earth to Pluto. If you took Earth's moon, which is much smaller than Earth, and compared it to Pluto, Pluto is about 60% the size of our moon. And so smaller still, but yet, interestingly enough, now our moon does not have an atmosphere at all. It's pretty much vacuum. There might be some rarefied, if you really took some very sensitive instrumentation to the moon, to Earth's moon, you potentially could find some atmosphere. But interestingly enough, little Pluto, sitting way out there at the edge of the solar system, 39 astronomical distances, in other words, 39 times the distance from the sun, from Earth to the sun, little Pluto has an atmosphere that if you put it next to Earth, the atmosphere of Pluto would be bigger than Earth itself. So very interesting, very interesting. But then again, what really causes that atmosphere? And the answer is that Pluto is acting as a comet. It's discharging the solar capacitor. It's building up the equivalent of a ion cloud. It's circular. It's the Debye shielding that goes on. It's a common characteristic of comets. And actually, it's probably much, much bigger, but very faint. And so the ability to detect the extent of its atmosphere, which is, in a sense, it's really not an atmosphere, it's a coma. Now, let's go back into history just a little bit, and I'll lead up to what was known about Pluto historically. In 1930, it was discovered, and remember that Uranus and Neptune, the outer two planets that are known today, were not known throughout history. The Greeks, the Romans, etc. They knew out to Saturn. They did not know about Uranus and Neptune, but the interesting thing was that the ancients knew about those other two planets, and they had names for them. They actually wrote about them. That was one of the interesting discoveries of Zachariah Sitchin, is in interpreting the cuneiform writing of the Sumerians. He discovered that there was not only those, but then there was another planet, which they called Nibiru. And that led to the whole legend of Nibiru, which in fact, as it turns out, was the nucleus of Hale-Bopp, the comet. And I have a whole DVD, a downloadable DVD that's available that talks about that. It's in my book CD DVD set. Okay, so in terms of modern astronomy, Uranus, the next planet out from Saturn, was discovered in 1781 by William Herschel, and he was looking for it because there were some peculiarities in the orbit of Saturn. And so he was looking, and he knew right where to look, so he discovered Uranus. And then as soon as they discovered Uranus, they discovered that they did some calculations, and it became apparent that there was some other planet out there still pulling on the other planets, causing perturbations in their orbits. And let me just explain that a little bit. Say you went out to a planet like Uranus or Neptune, and you gave them a push. You could put a force on them and give them a little push. Right away in the beginning, you would not notice much of a change at all in its orbit. But over a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you would notice an increasingly large change in the orbit of the planet from where it was supposed to be. Okay, so this happened, and so first they discovered Uranus in 1781, William Herschel. Then in 1846, you know, a half a century later, John Herschel, son of William, discovers Neptune, the blue planet that was described by the Sumerians. But of course, they didn't know that at that time. And so no more than Neptune was discovered, and they realized that there were still oddities in the orbits of these all of these planets that were not accounted for by the presence of the newly discovered Uranus and Neptune. So there was a continual search that continued on, and literally almost 100 years later in 1930, Clyde Tombaugh accidentally, by doing a search in that region of the outer space, telescope search, discovers by accident the planet Pluto. Well, not exactly by accident. They were looking for this mysterious Planet X object. So the search for Planet X goes back to the time of Newton, literally, where they knew about the planets out to Saturn and then discovered one by one these planets. And so then Pluto was discovered, but what was known about it? Not very much at all. It was not very bright, indicating that it was probably very small, but they had no way of measuring that, given the telescopic equipment of the time. So it was up until the late 1970s, where Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory, and doing some studies, telescopic studies of Pluto, discovered that it had a moon. So now the gloves were off. The fact that Pluto had a moon gave them the ability to measure the mass of Pluto. And right away they discovered that the Pluto's mass was very small. It could not have been the Planet X object that they were looking for. Okay, so I hope you can start to see that this little planet Pluto is very interesting in a historical point of view. So at that point, they started a program which culminated in 1991 with Robert Harrington discovering the planet, that literally the 10th planet, which eventually became the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. But nobody talks about that, and that's what I discovered in my work, by basically detective work. That's available in the explanation of how all of this happened in my most recent book. It's called Planet X Update 2020, The Real History of Planet X. But even with that discovery, there appears to still be another object out there. Now, Hale-Bopp, when it was originally discovered and mapped in 1991, with the orbit calculation Robert Harrington gave, it was determined that it was on a near direct collision course with Earth. And so the intelligence community under President George Bush Sr. knew all about this. And then when they transitioned over to Clinton in 1992, NASA was taken over by the CIA. And this was the same time as the first Gulf War. The CIA bought CNN, which became the news outlet for the same news outlet that exists today, Disinformation Fake News Network. But at any rate, underlying in a lot of what happened at that time was the discovery of Planet X. Now, one interesting other bit of this, which I describe in my downloadable DVDs, etc., is that when Sitchin went to talk to Harrington, it was in around 1986, Harrington showed him an orbit that was an estimate of the Planet X that they were looking for, and it was down in the solar system. It was pulling down on the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. And I'm not going to go through all of the details of this, but Harrington told Sitchin, and it's on tape, you can see this, it's on camera, that he believed at that time that the orbit was 3,600 years. Well, he was wrong. The orbit turned out to be 4,250 years. But Sitchin took that information, wrote it in a book, and then everybody after that, except myself, picked up that number and repeated it. People are still repeating it today, and it's a fictitious number, it's not real, etc. But at any rate, be that as it may, all of this involves also the discovery of the planet Pluto. And okay, so now I just wanted to give you an idea of some of the history of what was known about Pluto. Then fast forward to the New Horizons spacecraft, which flew by Pluto in July of 2015. So that was a very interesting event. And one thing that I did is I made some public predictions. And I said, when they get out to Pluto, they're going to discover that it is a comet. And the reason I knew that is because it was on the edge of the nebular ion cloud. It was on the inside edge. And that's why it is much more active than the inner planets, Uranus and Neptune, for example. Those are another topic for another week. But they're not quite as interesting as Pluto. There's something about Pluto that is absolutely remarkable. And so as the spacecraft New Horizons started getting close to the planet Pluto and its moon system, turns out there's five moons orbiting Pluto, not just Charon, but four other ones. It turns out that all of these objects have comet tails. And you can see when the Charon would move around the planet Pluto, it would bring its comet tail with it. And so this is the atmospheres that they believed were around Pluto. They could detect the atmospheres. There were other optical methods of detecting the atmosphere of Pluto. But the atmosphere of Pluto is very extensive. But like I said, it's not truly an atmosphere held by gravity. It's an atmosphere that's held in place because it's an ionic attraction, and Pluto is negatively charged because it's discharging the solar capacitor. It's acting as a comet. But so you could see this. You could see this cometary activity involved in the moons as they went around Pluto, and you could see the comet tails moving with them. And it was very clear. NASA, of course, tried to hide that data. I captured it and publicized it. But then, very interestingly, once the New Horizons spacecraft got out to Pluto, it was snowing. It was snowing in the atmosphere of Pluto. And where's the snow coming from? It's coming from outside. And the snow was consisting not so much of water ice, but chemicals like ammonia, nitrogen-hydrogen compounds that have very low freezing temperature. And so basically, the other thing that was very interesting about Pluto were the surface features, which looked like, I call it a milk boil. And if you've ever seen, if you took raw milk with just right out of the, taken from the cow, and you put it in a pan, and you put a low heat on it, eventually what's going to happen is it's going to bubble up, the surface is going to solidify, and the whole top is going to rise up. And then it's going to start to fracture, and it's going to start to form like mountainous regions. And that's exactly what you see on the surface of Pluto. So it tells you that Pluto has an internal heat source, something that if this planet Pluto were 4.5 billion years old, like they claimed it should have been, but now it's not a planet, so it, I mean, it's all goofy. It's standard science is, goofy. But demoting Pluto from being a planet, then did it not form like the other planets? Then how did it form? And of course, they don't answer any of those questions with the problem of demoting a planet and then just leaving it in Never Never Land, in limbo, so to speak, in the planetary world. How did Pluto form then, Mr. Standard Scientist, Astronomer Carl Sagan or whoever? How did Pluto form? And it had to have a heat process because it's spherical. So anyway, it's just goofy. But what's important to understand is that there are hundreds, thousands of these Pluto-like planets out beyond the far reaches of our solar system. So as it turns out, as you study my work on the plasma discharge comet model, one of the properties of a fusion star is that capacitor out there. It's the material is held back by solar wind pressure, and the ultraviolet light from the sun ionizes the material and maintains the ionization so that it's the other side of the capacitor. But what happens is that Pluto and all these thousands of other planets are in that rich zone of material. And so they're discharging the solar capacitor, which means they're building up, just like the cometary process, just like Hale-Bopp the comet was building up, becoming larger and larger during its six-year stay in the solar system. All of the planets are to a much lesser degree discharging the solar capacitor and building up material and becoming larger. Earth is gaining material all the time. Earth is gaining water mass all of the time, although just a little bit. It's coming in all of the time, 24/7. But the interesting thing here is that the material that's in the nebular ion cloud, these are the light elements. These are the hydrogen-nitrogen compounds, not a lot of water. There are some carbon-hydrogen compounds, but the very light, the low-mass, low-density ones. And also what happens is the solar wind has a differential process where the heavier elements are around the sun, in the region of the sun, like iron and nickel, etc. And that's why Earth and Mercury and Venus are primarily composed of iron, nickel, and Mars has a constituency of sulfur, and that's because when it was in its comet stage, it was drawing in material from the region around Jupiter, which has a lot of sulfur content. And then as you work your way out through the solar system, you get out to lighter and lighter materials, with Uranus and Neptune being oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, and nitrogen. So organic materials. You could have a field day out there doing organic chemistry, because all of the substance, if you look at Titan, the big moon of Saturn, hydrocarbons, you could probably build a pretty nice oil refinery, although I think we're going to be off petroleum before we ever get out to Titan to mine its petroleum products. But back to Pluto being on the edge of this rich organic cloud of material out there, is primarily very light elements, and it's so cold that when they come into the atmosphere and rain in, they turn into crystalline form and fall in the form of snow. And you can see the layering of snow as it falls through the atmosphere of Pluto in the photos that were taken by the New Horizons spacecraft. But of course, NASA doesn't know what it's looking at, doesn't have a clue. And, I don't know what they're thinking, because this planet is nothing like what one would expect if it formed 4.5 billion years ago. But that might be another reason why they had to demote it, was because there's no way of explaining, with their standard theory of how planets form, there's no way of explaining how this planet Pluto formed, because it is still forming. It's still in the process of formation. Its moon Charon is continually building up and becoming bigger. And so eventually, after a long enough period of time, Charon will orbit in closer and closer to where it becomes an actual part of Pluto. And so that would be very interesting to see, if we ever get to other solar systems, other planet systems, to find two planets, a moon and a planet, that merged. They just kept getting closer and closer together until finally they touched, and there they are. They're the a pair of planetary objects touching and gravitationally bound together. Wouldn't be a big collision. It'd be somewhat of a mild local collision, but that would be really interesting to see a dual planet coupled together and then still in the process of formation, with layers and layers building up. Eventually, maybe it would just be this oblong egg-shaped structure, this planet, but it's something interesting to think about. So Pluto is gaining mass. You can see it. I mean, you can see the material raining in from outside, coming down through the atmosphere, settling on the surface of the planet. And like I said in the beginning, the atmosphere of Pluto is enormous, absolutely enormous, based on because it's not a true atmosphere. It's not a true atmosphere in the sense that atmosphere is being held to the planet by gravity. It is an atmosphere, actually a coma. And I mentioned a word before, I'll put some meaning to it, Debye shielding. Here's what happens in a laboratory. If you take an electrically charged object, let's say you have a chamber and you can isolate materials, so you take a pin and you put on the end of your pin a steel ball, and you put that inside of the chamber, and then all of a sudden you can put an electric charge on this ball and you put it in an atmosphere, and what you're going to see is that surface of that ball is going to develop a charge shielding around it called Debye shielding. And so if it's a negative charge, then the positive ions will gather around it and form literally a plasma shield. And so that's what's going on with Pluto. It's acting as a comet. The planet itself is negatively charged, and so it's developing a coma, or a Debye shielding plasma, spherical plasma. And these come because it's a singularity charge, these then form in the form of a circle. So that's why the atmosphere is in the form of a circle, but also a little bit elongated, because it has to combine with the electric field of the sun. But at any rate, that's why Pluto has this alleged atmosphere. And now, how did Pluto get its start? Pluto got its start from a very small core. And so, like any object, it may have been something as small as a dust grain, where it's moving through space and comes into the region of the nebular ion cloud, and all of a sudden it starts slowing down, drawing in material, discharging the solar capacitor, and starts gathering material, and then eventually ends up looking like the planet that we see today. So let me switch gears a little bit here and start talking about orbits. Because when you talk about Pluto, you're also talking about all of these other planets that are out there. And what's strange, I would say it's interesting but strange, is that NASA does not publish the orbits of all of these objects. After discovering about 40 of these objects, of which they now know there are thousands, and have actually discovered thousands of all different sizes, they stopped publishing the orbital information, which means in my book they probably have discovered some that are on orbits that potentially could bring them into the inner solar system. And so they're not talking. This is a humorous story, and I was listening live to this. This is back in probably the mid-2000s. This guy named Michael Brown, who discovered Sedna, which is the first planet outside of Pluto to be discovered. And they, at that time, were calling it a minor planet, or still calling it a planet, or a dwarf planet, or whatever. But anyway, he was in a live interview. And what's interesting about, or strange, as I say, about these young astronomers is they were totally cloistered and removed from anything dealing with Velikovsky or the idea that comets could come into the solar system and cause havoc, or they were completely removed from the idea that Robert Harrington of the Naval Observatory discovered Planet X, literally the 10th planet, that was predicted by the Sumerians, and that it was on a near direct collision course with Earth, and eventually was discovered by civilians as the nucleus of the comet Hale-Bopp, etc. But what's interesting is Michael Brown was in this interview, and it was the Reuters news reporter gets up and asks him a question. And, of course, Sedna is, because of its the brilliance of this object, the reflectivity of the object, they consider that it's covered with ice, and that's a fair assumption. So at any rate, that would make it, if it came into the inner solar system, according to standard astronomy, of course they're incorrect, but they would say that would be a dirty snowball. So anyway, these writers... innocently gets the writer's reporter gets up and asks him, what would happen if this object came into the inner solar system? And he goes, oh, that would be the biggest comet anybody had ever seen. And within the older astronomers are very much aware of all the political hullabaloo that went on over Velikovsky and a big comet's coming into the solar system, etc. And of course, my work, which is the physics end of all of this, explaining how the processes work, the discharge of the solar capacitor, the plasma discharge comet model, how small comets can become bigger and the bigger ones can eventually become planets, etc. So unbeknownst to Michael Brown, the young astronomer, green behind the ears, unbeknownst to him, he let the cat out of the bag and... basically stated the obvious that if some object like this were to come into the inner solar system, it could potentially have repercussions and become the biggest comet that anybody had ever seen. So I thought that was just comical. And it was kind of the payback, so to speak, for professional astronomers not teaching their students, harboring them like just like little kids who've been kept away from reality and life. And once they get out into college or into real life, they go wild because the parents had cloistered them so much when they were little. So anyway, that is just a humorous story about the Pluto and the beyond Pluto planets. The first one to be discovered was called Sedna. But what about the orbits of these objects? NASA's not talking. And if you took a random sampling of orbits, just let's take another random sampling of orbits that we know about, and that's the asteroid belt. If you look at the asteroid belt, there was a program that I still have it. It'll still run on some of the old computers, which I, by the way, saved so that they will run some of the old software from decades ago. But there was a program called Dance of the Planets. And it ran on an old, PC, personal computer. And anyway, it had a portion in there. You could take a planet and look at its orbit, etc. But it had the orbits of a couple thousand asteroids. And so you could start out, and it would start out by showing the orbit of one, and then two, and then three, and four, and five. And then within a short amount of time, you had thousands of orbits of asteroids. But what was interesting is you think of the asteroid belt as something like the rings of Saturn, this flat belt with all of the asteroids nice and neatly going around the sun, but that's not the case. The real situation is when you look at the orbits of thousands of the asteroids between Mars and Jupiter, they're in all kinds of orbits, retrograde orbits going in the opposite direction. They're going in highly elliptical orbits. They're going in orbits with high inclination, meaning they're way out of the plane of the planets. So you get this wide array of orbits of objects that are in the solar system. So you would expect the same thing to happen. Taking a statistical average, all of these objects, these thousands of new planets, are not going to be in nice, neat little orbits going around the sun like in the plane of the planets. It's not going to happen. So they're going to be all over the place. And so some of them may go much farther out. When they were discovered, they might be at their closest point to the sun. And there might be some that, when discovered, that was their farthest point from the sun. And so anyway, the whole story here is that we don't really know what the orbits of these objects are, but just from a statistical point of view, you can bet that there are some of those objects that would be eventually come into the solar system and eventually might become planets. And that's where the danger comes in, because once an object comes in, and this is statistically very rare, once an object comes into the solar system and is captured into the plane of the planets, then it's typically going to be in an elliptical orbit, which means it's going to be discharging the solar capacitor extensively. It's going to be circularizing its orbit, and it's going to have its orbital energy reduced. These are the main effects, as I outline in my comet papers. But what does that mean? That means eventually they're going to encounter the planets on a close-up basis. And so if one of these objects, even though it might be small, something, you know, a tenth the size, the diameter of Earth, if it comes by fast and it's also electrically active with a potential much different than Earth, then we could have serious repercussions, action at a distance, I call it, the term I coined in my original work. And so potentially some of these objects could be not necessarily earth-shattering, but could affect Mars or Venus or Mercury or Jupiter. This is a possibility. And of course, with NASA not talking about the orbits, we simply don't know what the orbits are or which ones potentially could come in. And I just want to make something clear also. When something obtuse comes into the solar system, the probability of it coming close enough to Earth is really, really small. Because Earth is moving in its orbit, Earth is relatively small compared to the size of the solar system. So having some kind of direct collision is very, very rare. But it has happened. And so anyway, I don't want to create fear here. And that's not the point. The point is to describe what's going on. And the other thing is, if I ever heard of something that was, say, coming into the solar system that presented some kind of an issue, then I would report that. And I would give the conditions, etc. But the one that really had potential for causing Earth damage was the comet Hale-Bopp. And it slowed down in its orbit. The tail drag reduced its orbit. And eventually we missed that comet by about 90 days. About 3 months, we had moved ahead in our orbits. And originally it was on a very close direct collision course with Earth. And that's why all the secrecy, that's why all the CIA disinformation programs, that's why in the military, etc. Through the 90s, it was just very bizarre. And I'm not going to go into all of the details that happened back then, but it was very strange. They're very strange times, and a lot of misinformation campaigns. And so now I'm going to talk, this is going to get a little bit more interesting here. So for some of you, this may have been a bit mundane up to this point. But here is the interesting part. Of all of the thousands, and I would say upwards of possibly 10,000 planets forming out in this nebular ion region. And by the way, you can look at other, if you look in my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, there's a picture of the Eskimo Nebula, to a nearby star with a similar nebular ion cloud around it. You can see the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of planets in formation in the form of comets. You can see the comet tails. And so these planets are forming very slowly. But what is the probability, what is the possibility, say there were 10,000 of them out there, or say there were 100,000? The number is not really relevant. The question is, what percentage of them might be on orbits that could bring them into the inner solar system, something that potentially could affect Earth? And the answer is that potentially not many of them. And if there were, you would see them coming in. There's a comet right now called K2, but it's coming in. It will not get any closer than the orbit of Mars. And so there's a lot of, anytime one of these things happens, you get immense amount of speculation by non-scientists on YouTube. And so I get these emails all the time. People go, oh, did you see this? Somebody's predicting the end of the world and Planet X is by the sun. And oh, I mean, it just doesn't end. It just gets goofier and goofier. But anyway, the rule of thumb is do not get any science information from YouTube. It's not the place to go for any real information. The people that are there are looking for maybe YouTube dollars or something. But do not get your information on YouTube, and please don't send me any, because I'm simply going to ignore it. But the point is that here's something really important about the work I did in discovering that the object that Robert Harrington discovered, in which, by the way, he died before it was publicly discovered as the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. But now let's go back 4,250 years when that object was in the solar system previously. And remember, it was losing orbital a period during the previous time it was here. So potentially it was in the inner solar system maybe 6,000 years ago. That's about the time of the Great Noah's Flood. And so, but that doesn't prove that that was the comet that we went through the tail and caused the Great Noah's Flood. It does not prove anything. It's just around the right time scale. But there were many other big comets in the solar system at that time. The point of all of this discussion is that we don't have, because even if you go back thousands of years where people were recording, for example, Halley's Comet, it was recorded on the Bayeux Tapestry in the Middle Ages. It was recorded by the Chinese in periods B.C. So astronomical records are here, but only for a few thousand years. Some of these comets, big ones, might be on, like, for example, Hale-Bopp. We're talking close to 6,000 years ago. We really don't have astronomical records that go back that far. And to understand if that was the comet that caused the Noah's Flood, or to potentially, this is another more probable situation, that the Hale-Bopp nucleus, which Planet X, Robert Harrington discovering it, had no effect on Earth at all on the previous visit, or potentially on the previous 10 visits. And that someone made a prediction, potentially, at some point in time, that when it came back, it might have a close approach to Earth, which it was going to, except if anybody understood the plasma discharge comet model, they would have understood that it was going to lose it was going to lose ground, so to speak, in its orbit. And Earth, even though it was on a near direct collision course when it was first discovered, after it became a comet, after it lost orbital period, after it lost energy in its orbit and Earth moved ahead in its orbit, there was no real interaction with Hale-Bopp and Earth at all. The thing that did affect Earth was the excitation of the sun. So the comet discharging the solar capacitor raised the energy level of the sun and to levels that much higher than it had been previously. And so we were experiencing very severe weather on planet Earth during that entire six-year period that Hale-Bopp was in the solar system. So those are side effects or collateral damage caused by comets, big comets. In a sense, Hale-Bopp was not that big. It wasn't as big as some of the really big comets in history. And so what people have to understand is that every time a large object comes into the solar system, it would appear as a comet, but every time it comes into the solar system, it does not have to affect Earth or Mars or even any other planets. In fact, it's only on rare occasions when it does affect things. Earth is a very small target, moving very fast in outer space. So the idea that something's going to come nipping by it at close range is extremely remote possibility, extremely remote, unless, as you had in the case of Venus, the comet coming through the solar system, it was in the plane of the planets. Then you're going to have some close encounters. But unless that happens, and there again, that's an extremely rare event when an object comes in the plane of the planets, it's not out of the question, but it's just extremely rare. And, for example, the comet Hale-Bopp was in an orbit perpendicular to the orbit of the planets. And so there's only one small point where the comet crosses the ecliptic, the plane of the planets, where there's even the possibility of interacting with planets at all. And that would require that the Earth is exactly right in that portion of its orbit at that time. Very, very low probability of any of these things happening. But they have happened in the past. There was probably 10 points in Earth's history where there were mass extinctions due to passing large celestial objects. Okay, so I'm going to change subjects here a little bit and talk about energy and the future of energy on Earth. So as you all know, I'm working on a project. I call it the World Energy Water Project, and it's somewhat expanded from there to be the World Energy Water Food Project because I've included the grow towers in my product line. But the world energy situation is at a crisis level. There are statistics which show the number of people who are without electricity. Literally, they don't have electricity. And of course, sub-Sahara Africa is prime target. Most of the developed world has some semblance of electricity, but it's very sketchy. The United States and the developed world, oddly enough, is really in for a beating when it comes to electricity. And I have to say that nobody in the position of leadership, whether it's in the military or whether it's in the executive branch of the government or whether it was Trump or Biden, or none of these people have a clue. And none of the people they put into the energy department have a clue either. These people, I don't know where they come from or where they get their education or backgrounds, but they have no understanding of the dire problems that are going on in the world today, relative to energy, especially in the first world countries. They're calling nuclear fuel green. It's the most horrific pollutant that man has ever devised, yet it's green, because it doesn't produce CO2, they say. But I'm going to venture to say that everybody listening to this show tonight will experience power outages in the next year. And some of them might be very severe. Some of them might be just temporary, a few hours, a few minutes. But That is coming, and the biggest issue that's coming is the financial demise of the central power companies. Now, what happened probably about 20 years ago, it began to happen. There's an agency within the state governments called the PUC, the Public Utility Commission. And what they allowed to happen, these were publicly held utilities. The power company, the gas company, and many other forms of utilities, the telephone company, etc. And so what they did is they broke up. They said, oh, there's a monopoly there. And so they broke them up, and in come private companies to buy these up, for run them for profit. Now, I know accountants that have worked for energy companies, and the rule was you spend as much money as possible. You buy, if you don't buy just one computer system, if somebody needs a computer system, you buy 100 computer systems. In the case of three-blade wind turbines, these companies, these power companies have gone out and purchased massive amounts of wind energy. They talk about their nameplate value. And that's the, if you took the maximum amount of power produced by a given wind energy device or solar device, that would be its nameplate value. It's never going to produce that in its entire lifetime. It might do that in a couple of days out of its entire lifetime. But on average, it's not going to produce anywhere near that. And but anyway, they made massive investments in wind energy. That's why Germany right now has to ration power, because they were depending. They said, oh, we're going to depend on alternative energy. We're going to be green. And it doesn't work. So they have to ration energy. That's why I developed the wing generator, and I'm not going to talk extensively about that, but it is the solution for the worldwide issue of energy. But the standard traditional three-blade wind turbine and solar power were developed to fail and to put a lot of investment in those, and when the public would wake up someday, which is today, to this failure, then the big power companies would say, well, we got to go back to central power company power. And that's what's exactly going on today. But the problem is that even though that strategy has worked, the central power companies are all on the verge of financial collapse. And so within the next year or two, you're going to see all of the major electric power companies failing. And as I said, they were once run. There was a public utility commission in every state, and that public utility commission oversaw the operation and finances and accountability of the public utilities. Well, that's still there. The PUC is still there, but they don't have any power and they don't do anything. They don't regulate anything and they have no oversight over the books of the private utility companies, which are there for profit. It's the same thing that happened in medicine when medicine was run for profit. Companies came in and bought out clinics and hospitals and medical facilities and test facilities and then run it for profit. And so profit is the motivation. Profit is the business decider. Profit is what runs the business, and not good business practices. So the PUCs have been out of the picture. They no longer operate, they no longer run, they no longer oversee the utilities. So now you have central power companies that have licensing, but in the communications world, in telecommunications, you have dozens of companies that have come in, built their own infrastructure, have their own corporate structure. So you're paying, say you pay for one of, I'm not going to mention names, but say you pay your cell phone bill to one of the telecommunications cell phone companies, then you are paying redundant services because that company has all its executives, support staff, etc., profit margin, and that is totally independent, and equipment. They have to set up all their own equipment. They don't share equipment. And so you have the reproduction of equipment on a massive scale. And there's no oversight of this. These are run for profit. But the energy industry is on the verge of collapse. And so how does one come in and resolve these issues? The EMP issue, that's another thing. When I was on Coast to Coast just a couple of weeks ago, George Norrie asked me about this. How do you solve that? And I explained very simply on the air how the shunts and the inductors and the equipment that is very inexpensive to prevent EMP destruction of the power grid. Yeah, but it never goes anyplace. That's because everything becomes political, and just like voter fraud, just like every other thing that is brought in, medical or medicine for all or whatever it is brought in front of Congress, it's going to fail because these people are completely inept idiots. So I will no longer talk about politics. I will no longer talk about anything related to government because it's going to fail. It has failed on a massive scale. And but anyway, back to the issue of providing electricity for the world, it's an immense problem, not only because you have to build infrastructure and some kind of power setup for a lot of the third world countries, but you have to overcome the bad management of the big central power companies in first world countries. An immense problem, absolutely immense. So anyway, what I'm telling people is that you simply should get off the grid. And to do that costs money. It's not inexpensive. You're replacing all of that central power company equipment, that your portion of it that provides you with electricity, and then also have your own water, food, and especially greens and vegetables. You can eat a little bit of protein and have starch, either potatoes or rice or noodles or wheat or whatever. But you need green vegetables. You need the fresh vegetables in your diet, or you're not going to last very long at all. Anyway, that's why I've developed the programs I've developed on my webpage. I encourage you to go take a look at those and become prepared. My webpage is jmccsci.com. There are still a number of sales on for the water filter products, my education, K-12 education packages, etc., and the books, the book libraries, etc., all on sale. It'll still say Christmas sale, but if you look at the pricing, all the pricing has been significantly reduced, and free shipping primarily to the 48 states, some of the free shipping to the 50 states. So once again, this is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.